You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko India toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ke te wire mo tēnei rā. Kia ora, welcome to The Wire for Tuesday the 8th of August. I'm joined by my producer Jack in studio, and we also have some great interviews from reporter Mac for you today. Coming up on the show today, we're joined by former Green Party MP Sue Bradford about the resignation and possible suspension of two current MPs. We also discuss this issue with Marama Fox. For the Green Desk, we speak to Lily Peacock, who has been on a week-long research internship with dolphin conservation group MOM. We speak to the students delivering a petition calling for better sex education in high schools and talk to the National Council of Women about why they support it. We speak to the owner of New Zealand Research Vessel, which has angered Vanuatu's government by operating in waters it disputes with France. And we look back at a mud festival controversy which has brewed over in Rotorua over the weekend involving fears of an outbreak of foot and mouth disease. If you want to let us know your thoughts on any issues we cover, please give us a call, 309 3879, or a text on 5395.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
First up, the Green Party is in the midst of suspending two of its MPs after they threatened to leave unless co-leader Matiria Ture steps down. David Clendon and Kennedy Graham told RNZ Ture's position was untenable following her admission she lied to Work and Income while on the benefit and enrolled in an electorate she didn't live in. Co-leader James Shaw said the move was a betrayal and he would seek to suspend both of them. We're now joined by former Green MP Sue Bradford. Hi, Sue.
Hi, kia ora.
So first of all, what did you think of Matiria's admission to benefit for? Do you think that was worth the political risk?
It's a bit hard to say at the moment. I mean, I think that she probably didn't realise quite how the predicament that she would put herself in personally. But at the same time, it was a very brave stand and helped has helped the Greens enormously in terms of the credibility of the welfare policy that she was putting forward, and the fact that they have a one of their leaders who is prepared to talk openly about her experience of life on the benefit. And that's meant an awful amount to many people who are struggling right now at Work and Income or have had a really tough time with them in the past. You totally understand where Matiria is coming from. And I think at this stage, it's been great to see James Shaw, other Green MPs and other Green Party leaders coming out and saying, no, we're backing our leader and we're not going to bend to the pressure that Kennedy and Dave Clendon are putting on them.
Yeah, so what do you make of these two MPs resigning and the approach that they took to this resignation?
Well, it's unprecedented in the Green Party to have MPs resigning like this at very short notice without going through party processes, totally trying to hold the caucus and party to ransom. I can see why the caucus is and the leadership is so alarmed by their actions. Usually tensions within the Green Party have not become open in this way before. It's really unusual. And marks a big shift in the how people are going to perceive the Green Party, because of course, like any other political party, there always have been internal dissent, internal, I don't know, civil wars, internal factions. It's just never really revealed itself very much before, and this is the first time it's happened. But at this stage, I'd just say good on the caucus and the leadership for holding strong and backing Matiria in the difficult position she's ended up in as a result of supporting really good welfare policy.
Yeah, so do you think James Shaw is making the right call to suspend them?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think the Greens have any choice. Either they cave to these two or they carry on and hold the integrity of their caucus and party. And so far, all the evidence is that they're going to hang tight and stick with the honourable road. I mean, it sounds like David and Kennedy have bowed to pressure from the right, from other political parties, from the commentariat, from all the outraged right-wing voters who always like to think that, beneficiaries, you can smash onto beneficiaries, but if it's tax fraud or something like that, that's fine. So I think it's really great the Greens have been making a stand on this.
So looking ahead, how do you think this controversy will affect the party and their perception by the public heading into the election?
If the Greens stay strong with Matiria and their welfare policy, I think that the Greens will continue to catch votes from beneficiaries and people on the left that they wouldn't have had a hope of catching just a few weeks ago.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Sue.
Thank you. Bye.
See you.
Do you want to drop me here?
That was Sue Bradford speaking about two MPs possibly being stood down by the Green Party. We also spoke with Māori Party co-leader Marama Fox about this, who told reporter Max Smith, "By the leadership is up to for the Greens to decide, she's spoken with Matidia Ture and offered her support."
It's time to chat politics with Māori Party co-leader Marama Fox.
I've supported her to date because there are a lot of people who face hardship in this country who have done things that they needed to do to get by. I've also said, however, there are a lot of people in this country who have tried to live by the rules and with integrity who continue to struggle. And we were a family like that who tried to do it the right way. And, you know, we did the best that we could at the time. But it's not about throwing stones. It's like, let's have a look at the pros and cons here. We've got people in this country who have been slagging off about women on the DPB for years as if they're ripping off the government, and this has sort of played into their hands and confirmed to people that that's exactly what happens on the DPB, when actually it's not. There are a lot of women and a lot of men who look after their children because of circumstances where families have broken apart, and do it hard and do it right. There are people who elevate themselves out of beneficiary dependency to get where they are, which one of them is Matidia at this point, and others, but who have also done it by integrity. So it is a valid debate to be having, and it's certainly polarising to the nation, both those who support and those who don't. So while I support Matidia as a person who's, you know, battled against poverty and all of those things, you know, we do hold ourselves to a different standard. But if you look around Parliament and say, "He who is without sin cast the first stone," gee, there wouldn't be a lot of people left standing, I believe.
Right, and so when you say you had to do things in a similar way, but in the right way, could you have ever seen yourself pushed into a situation where Matidia, at least claims she was pushed into, where she had to lie to get by and to feed her family?
Look, when you've got a family struggling, when you are struggling to feed your children, when you are struggling to pay the bills and deciding this week whether we pay the rent or whether we pay for food or whether we pay the power or whether we pay the food or ring around to people who you owe money to. I mean, we all have had those circumstances. You know, if you ring somebody on a cell phone and it's got a blocked number, nobody answers it because it's somebody looking for money or somebody doing a dumb survey. So everybody understands what that feels like. And I can't guarantee that we've been completely squeaky free, squeaky clean our whole lives. If I went back now and had a look at everything we did, you know, we tried to live by integrity. That's what we tried to do. And I know that Matidia, since being in Parliament, has lived by the same standards. And lots of people did dumb things when they were kids. And that's why we grow and we mature and we move on.
Well, I think squeaky clean is a little bit, well, how I interpret it, is a little bit different than by misleading and indeed lying to work an income to claim a larger benefit, wouldn't you think?
Yes, I mean, yes, obviously, but if I looked around my relatives and people I know back in the day, now I wouldn't know what people are up to. I don't ask those questions. I know that they're struggling and it's hard, and that they people do what they need to. I know that we'd go out to the beach to get kaimwana so that we'd have something in our fridge. We'd go, my husband would work as a farmer, I mean as a shearer on farms where he'd shear so many sheep, and instead of getting paid in cash, not cash, but you know, paid wages for that, he'd take a sheep instead. Is that illegal? You know, we did what we needed to do to eat as well. So I think if you ask anybody that, that's what people would admit to having to do what they need to do to have food on their table. But I've never gone into a supermarket and tried to steal food. Where other people have done that, you know, there's people who have been penalised for misleading wins and been thrown in jail, and there's people who have tax fraud who aren't. I mean, if we look at corporate welfare and corporate tax evasion, how many of those people are are, you know, put into jail or held up to account the way she has. Politics is a game where if you don't come off looking good, everybody jumps on your back. But everybody who jumps on your back, if they were very honest about looking at what they've done, if they never had a cashy job for plumbing or for know a friend who painted the house for them for nothing, where they may have got wages instead, you know, it can go on and on and on. It's a murky place, and you're either on one side or you're not. And I think that's for the nation to decide. I also think it's for the Greens Party to decide whether Matidia stays. And at the moment, it just looks like it's imploding. At the moment, it looks like that Labor without the Greens won't get there on their own. No matter what sort of upswing they get in the very short time that we have left, they're going to fight it out. The Greens are going to fight it out. Everybody is trying to get to the Iron Throne, I guess, so that they can have the opportunity to run the government and the country in the way that they think is best for this nation. We know, as the Māori Party, we would like to be at the table no matter who gets there. And we're telling people, if they've lost faith and they don't know where to place their vote, place it with us, because we sit in the middle and we try to hold both sides to account. And what we do is fight for value add to this nation, recognising people's assets, not people's deficits, because this country is built on the hard work of labouring families, of business owners, of migrants who come here to settle, to add to this nation, and we all need to do it together. So either we get on board and do what we think is right to bring all people along with us and not leave a group of people suffering under hardship of poverty and despair, then we aren't winning as a country.
That was Marama Fox for the Māori Party.
The Wire.
That was Marama Fox speaking about the Green Party controversy with two MPs resigning over Matidia Ture's benefit fraud admissions. We're just going to have a quick break, and next up we have the Green Desk.
Orcon IRL is back, live at the Golden Dawn for The Election One. Host Russell Brown and BFM's Jogai Jimena will be answering all of your most burning election queries. Featuring a stellar lineup of the political who's who, keep an eye on 95bfm.com to RSVP and for the full announcement. Orcon IRL, The Election One, live at the Golden Dawn, Sunday, August 13, 4 to 7pm. Streaming live on 95bfm.com and our Facebook page. Thanks to Orcon and BFM for the stream.
Flying out and 95BFM present The Others Way 2017, and what a doozy it is, featuring Beck Runga, Lawrence Arabia, Sneaky Feelings, Jonathan Bree, The Courtneys, Street Chan, Micronism, Kane Strait, Mermaidens, Disaster Radio, Yokozuna, Soccer Practice, Hopetown Brown, Merc, Avoid Avoid, Eyes No Eyes, Hex, Queen Neptune, Unsanitary Napkin, and even more to be announced. The Others Way 2017. For tickets and more information, go to flyingout.co.nz. Babe, time machine, sussed. I'm a genius. Where are we headed? Summer of Love, King Arthur's Court?
Nah, like 2015? Hotline Bling? Hello? Sorry? Leo and the Revenant? No Brexit or Trump? The USA burger.
I don't actually know.
Yum. Burger's back, babe. Let's hit some Westworld shit.
Burger Fuels USA is back. American mustard, bacon, hash browns, New Zealand cheddar, 100% pure grass-fed New Zealand beef, smashed, juicy, make flavour country great again.
Tune into breakfast all week for your chance to win USAs for you and a mate. Sweet.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Hello? Hello? If you can hear me, I'm sending this message from the year 2038 to tell you one thing. Lily was right. Lily was right.
Want a better future for the planet? Then listen up. This is the Green Desk with Lily Peacock, thanks to the Monaco Beautification Charitable Trust.
You may have noticed Lily Peacock's absence from the Green Desk over the past few weeks. Our usual host has been in Greece on a week-long research internship with dolphin conservation group MOM. Reporter Max Smith spoke to Lily, who's in Berlin at the moment, about what she's been up to over the period.
I've been on the island of Lonisos, which is in a group of islands. They drifted off from us some time ago, so they're super green and covered in pines. The island I was on was right next to the island called Skopilos. It was filmed, so it's really, really beautiful. I was working with an NGO called the Hellenic Society for the Protection of Monk Seals. and they've been based on Ohlone sauce for about 30 years. When they started out, they just were working with rehabilitating monk seals. So they're normally solitary monk seals, live in caves around the place, and were killed off by a lot of people, like a lot of fishermen, because they were competing with fishermen for prey and things like that. So they weren't very popular on the island. Anyway, this company had been working there for 30 years, educating the public and doing a lot of good work, rehabilitating babies and taking care of everything. Anyway, about 5 years ago, they started researching northern Aegean striped dolphins and bottlenose dolphins and common dolphins in the North Aegean, where they are. There's actually not that much research on dolphins in the Mediterranean in general, so this was kind of a bit of an explorative like exercise for them, because they didn't have much to go on. So they started taking photos of fins and trying to identify different dolphins and just keep track of what they were seeing and where they were seeing it, but it's taken a little while to kind of get an idea of like what's going on in the area. And this is the first year that they kind of really started doing heavy research into the population, particularly the northern striped dolphin, which there is like not very much known about as a species anyway.
Do we know whether these species are endangered or in any kind of threat, or is there just not even enough research for that?
I think they're listed as like potentially under threat, but I don't think they're endangered per se just yet. Like the northern Aegean striped dolphin's doing pretty well, but the problem with studying this particular dolphin is that they're normally found at incredible depths, like over 1,000 meters, so to study them is quite hard because you have to normally go out quite far to find them, and it's expensive. It's expensive to take a boat out and go looking for them in deep water, and deep water's rough, and trying to spot dolphin fins in deep water when it's lots of waves is like near impossible. So the reason that this particular island is a really good study site is that on the north side it drops down to like 1,200 meters within a few k's so of the coastline, so you don't have to go far out into the open water to see these dolphins. I think that's probably the biggest reason that there isn't much research on the northern Aegean striped dolphin, is just that they're mostly an open water dolphin, whereas like bottlenose and common are normally coastal.
What were you able to find out then about these dolphins? I assume you found them at this spot.
Yeah, we found them the first day, which was apparently quite rare. So we went out, we were looking for about 40 minutes, which I think was the fastest time that they'd spent like looking, the least amount of time they spent looking, and then found them. And essentially we were all sitting on this boat, all looking in all directions, and you just look for fins breaking the water, which honestly it's like a mirage. Sometimes you think you're seeing one and you're like, oh my god, I'm seeing a fin, and it's just a wave, you know, so it can be quite hard. But we did find them, and we found a small group of about 3 dolphins that were just foraging and moving around, and then we follow them. So we have a GPS tracker that we put on as soon as we start looking for them, and that just tracks where we're going, and once we find them, we follow them, count how many they are, we photograph their fins so we can identify them, and photographing their fins is kind of like marking and recapturing. Like if you identify a particular dolphin and you see it again, it's like, oh, we've caught, you know, in quotations, I caught this dolphin before, we photographed this fin before. So what they're trying to do with that is get an estimation of the population size. Like if we're seeing the same dolphins all the time, then there's a small population in the area. But if we're seeing new dolphins all the time, then there's obviously quite a large population and we're just scratching the surface. From what the research that they've been able to do, that they believe that there's quite a large population of northern striped dolphins in the area, which is a good sign. And we did see one newborn calf and a couple of year-old calves. So they are breeding, which is good. But the issue with their breeding is that generally the firstborn calf from a female will die. And that's not because of the environment, but it's because the mother's blubber is so full of pollutants from the water that when she breaks the blubber down to turn it into milk, she essentially poisons her calf. And that's a big issue for this population.
What are these pollutants in the water? Is that oil or...?
I don't think oil, because it's a hydrocarbon, because it breaks down in the water, but it'll be things like just toxic pollutants. It can be plastic that's gotten into the phytoplankton that's been carrying toxins that are attached to it. It can be all sorts of things. It's not a point source pollution, like it's not coming directly from this particular plant in the area or anything like that. It's just an accumulation of pollutants that are in the water, which can come from runoff, you know, from cities. It can come from plants, you know, dumping toxic waste. It can come from all of these sources. It's just all these anthropogenic sources that are ending up in the water that are then ending up in the food chain that are affecting these dolphins and other organisms in the ecosystem, which is a huge problem. And this is one of the side effects, is that most firstborn calves of northern striped dolphins are dying because of pollutants.
And so what is, I mean, obviously removing the pollutants from the water, but I mean, is part of the research to kind of, to get a better understanding of that threat and to deal with it?
First of all, the biggest part of this research at this stage is to get an understanding of just the general population, what's going on, how many are there, how are they breeding, what are they eating, when are they eating, what are their habits, like just learning their basic ecology, because essentially there's not much information on that at this point in time. So once that's understood and we can get a better idea of how the species is working and what their ecology is, then we can start to deal with problems like how's pollution affecting them, what's something that we can do to combat that, because obviously I don't think, and I'm not sure about this, but I don't think it's pollution from them ingesting it straight away, but it could be in their food source. And I mean, how do you deal with that? How do you take out pollution that the fish are eating or what the fish's food is eating? You know what I mean? Pollution, these kinds of things, like small bits of plastic that have accumulated toxins, are eaten by macroinvertebrates that then are eaten by bigger fish, and then bigger fish eat that fish, and so on and so forth. And then they accumulate in the cells of the dolphin. So dealing with that problem is a really complex issue, and it doesn't have one solution other than just not putting any more pollutants in the ocean.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a big ask to try and deal with trying to take them out of the ocean in the first place.
That was the Green Desk, thanks to the Monaco Beautification Charitable Trust.
Lily Peacock will be back hosting the Green Desk next week. Next up, today two Wellington students are taking a petition to Parliament calling for more comprehensive and consistent sex education to be taught in all high schools. They say the curriculum needs to include consent, what a healthy relationship looks like, and account for LGBTQI experiences. I spoke to Lauren Jack and Ruby Medlicott about the petition, which has gained almost 7,000 signatures so far. They say it was sparked by comments by Wellington College boys that were posted to a private Facebook group encouraging classmates to take advantage of drunk girls, but realised the issue goes much further than that.
It was more specifically created after the protest against rape culture outside Parliament. We've kind of realised that this isn't just comments made by some Wellington College boys. This is an issue that goes much further than that, and it's not just these boys making their comments, it's so many more people than that, and it's a much bigger issue.
Were the comments surprising to you, or were you already aware of this as quite a big issue in New Zealand?
I think that we were already aware that it was an issue, but I think that things like that always come as a shock. You know, hearing them is always not very pleasant to overhear and to hear about, because we don't want to be reminded that it's an issue, but it really is one. And I think that it brought to light that it's such a big issue that needs to be addressed.
What was it that made each one of you step up and say, I'm the one who's going to do something about this?
Lauren and I both attended a workshop several days before the comments were made, and one of the things we discussed was sex education and how it could be better improved. And then when these comments came to light and the protest was organised, we really thought that, you know, someone has to take action, and why shouldn't we? And with the help of Action Station, which is a campaigning platform, we were able to create our petition and our campaign and really get things moving to try and find a good solution.
A lot of it was the timing as well, because the comments had just been made and we'd just been to this workshop talking about it and there was so much media attention on it, we took advantage of that to create this campaign, hopefully when people would still be paying attention to it.
So what would you say is missing from current sex education in schools?
Well, the problem at the moment is that it's not consistent. And so some schools will have very little sex education and some will have very in-depth comprehensive sex education that covers a whole range of topics. And the problem is the discrepancies between different schools. And so what we need is consent, healthy relationships with LGBTQ inclusion to be taught at every single school in New Zealand.
You know, and especially when you're at high school, you're at such a vulnerable age.
Mm.
And it's so critical that we, as young people, are able to take control of our education and learn things such as how to be in a healthy relationship and why consent is so, so important to us.
So I saw that you'd picked a program, Mates and Dates, that you would like to see rolled out in schools. Could you tell me a bit about what that program would involve?
The cool thing about Mates and Dates is that they have a whole range of topics and different units that follow on from each other. And it goes from year 9 to year 13, which is really good. So each time it builds on what was learnt in the previous session or in the previous unit. And so it means that a whole range of topics is covered and, you know, every detail is covered as well, which is a lot better than what a lot of schools have at the moment.
And it's also taught not from teachers within a school. So that means that by specialists in the field, and it's often difficult trying to make changes to the education system because it is so up to teachers, and there may be teachers who are not comfortable teaching education. And so having it taught by people who are trained, people who are members of the community, and people who are willing to really educate the young people is a really beneficial to the program. And, you know, it's run by ACC. And we just think the program can really do great things, and it has been shown to do really great things within the school.
Do schools currently opt in to have that program taught, or how do you know how widespread it is at the moment?
So it's in quite a few schools in about 14 districts around the country, and so all that schools have to do is opt in for that program to be at their schools, and it's government funded, so it's of no additional cost to the school, which is really cool. I think that it's a really great option for schools.
So Hekia Parata has said that this is a topic that's better addressed in family homes, and some parents might reflect that view as well, saying that they might be the ones that want to teach their kids about this. What's your response to that viewpoint?
Well, our response is that teaching it just within families just isn't good enough. While it is incredibly important to have community and parental and family involvement in sex and sexuality in education, the problem is that there is such a high chance that this education will then become inconsistent. You know, some families might prefer to teach one thing and a different family might prefer to teach a completely different thing. Mm-hmm. And it is when there are those differences in education, that's when the issues start to crop up. And some parents may not be educated enough themselves to adequately teach their children. Another issue is that sexual violence happens within families. And if we leave this up to families, then it's just making so many more people around New Zealand more vulnerable to this.
So what's the response been to your petition so far from students and teachers? Could you tell me a bit about what people have said about it?
A lot of the feedback we've got from people have been really, really supportive. The teachers at our school and the students at our school have mostly been really, really supportive of what we're doing and are completely behind us. I think that there has been a little bit of negativity, but most of that isn't very vocal. You know, they kind of keep it to themselves a little bit. And so it's been really great to hear the support from everybody, and it's been really great to be in touch with people like the National Council of Women and people like that who are absolutely behind what we're doing.
Were you involved in politics at all before this issue arose, or how do you feel about the fact that you're delivering a petition to Parliament?
It's pretty crazy to think about, really. I mean, we've never really been that involved in politics. We've always been interested in it and quite up to date with it, I suppose, and very, you know, politically active in our own ways, but this is a whole new level for us.
Yeah, and it kind of just blew up, and then all of a sudden we're handing it into Parliament. I guess we just got to see where it goes from there. But it's been incredibly humbling, the amount of support we've gotten, and to see that so many other people around New Zealand care about the same issue, it's just, we feel very lucky.
Yeah. And every step of the way, we've been reassured that this is definitely something that needs to happen, and that what we're doing is an incredibly important step that this country needs to take in ending rape culture.
I also spoke to the Vice President of the National Council of Women, Vanessa Deru, about why the Council supports Ruby and Lauren's petition.
Well, we believe that best practice consent and healthy relationships are important for young people to be understanding and knowing in today's society, and education is a really good tool to reduce perpetration of sexual violence, and it's a big issue in our communities.
So what do you see as missing from current sex education?
What's missing is the ability to get the right people into our schools, and we don't want people to have just one-off sessions in classrooms, but to have skills-based activities that allow students to build on consent skills that they already have and practice them. And so I think that missing part of just being able to practice them and having them in different years consistently through the education system would really support today's women and men.
So what were the main kind of points that you supported in the campaign by Ruby and Lauren?
We want to help them argue that making consent is a compulsory part of the curriculum, and having healthy, or teaching healthy relationships with LGBTI plus inclusion, all the genders across New Zealand, help people start on a path of having great behaviour for relationships. And so we really support them in introducing that subject to the public and pushing for change in the education system.
And what do you think of the fact that this call has come from two students rather than, you know, teachers or someone at a more senior level?
I think it's important to have the voice of our young people saying what they want as part of their education system. They are in the best position to sort of understand exactly what's happening to them and perhaps articulate to others that are decision makers how important it is. And I think, you know, we should be supporting anyone that's a young person that's got something to say that will, they think that will help them and their friends and their other school colleagues have great relationships as they grow up.
Do you think the petition will be able to make a difference? Do you think it will be taken to the next step?
I think the act of young people giving this petition to our members of parliament is a great first step. I think petitioning and what we've seen in our history around petitioning, we get some outcomes and some understanding by our decision makers and government around how important it is, and the National Council Women fully support Lauren and Ruby to have their say and their democracy rights heard.
The Wire. That's funny. What does it sound like?
That was Vanessa Deru, the Vice President of the National Council of Women, speaking about the Council's support of a petition calling for better sex education that's being delivered to Parliament this afternoon. Next up, a New Zealand research vessel has angered Vanuatu's government by operating in waters at disputes with France. Both Vanuatu and the French territory of New Caledonia lay claim to the Matthew and Hunter Islands in the South Pacific and have been discussing boundary issues for the past 6 months. Vanuatu's Prime Minister, Charlotte Salwai, said the Braveheart ship, which has been carrying a marine science team around the island, had asked New Caledonia for permission, but not Vanuatu. He said Vanuatu was raising this issue with New Zealand, New Caledonia, and the United Nations. Nigel Jolly, the owner of Braveheart, only learned of the dispute by reading the morning paper in Fiji. Speaking from Suva, he told reporter Max Smith that he and his crew departed New Zealand for New Caledonia as part of a project for the Auckland War Memorial Museum.
Once we were up to Noumea, then we took on a group of scientists, and those scientists' responsibility was to obtain a scientific permit that would allow them to take samples, remove species from certain areas under New Caledonian control. Two of those islands are also, from what we find out, islands that Vanuatu claim ownership of. And it wasn't until I read the local newspaper here in Fiji this morning that I realised that there was a dispute going on. All we can go by, when I say we, myself and my captain, is when we look at a chart or we look at the pilot, which is the book that we navigate by, and it tells us which authority that we need to contact with relations to certain ports and islands that we wish to visit. In this case, it is Noumea that controls these two islands, Matthew and Hunter, which if you look at it geographically, or geographically, they seem to be part of Vanuatu, but from what we can find out is they were annexed by New Caledonia. Never mind, going back to the question, is we were in Noumea, the scientists got a permit to visit these islands and take on and take samples, take specimens, and that's what we did. We then, in Noumea, we had a permit to visit those islands and then exit the waters of New Caledonia and head to Suva. That's where we arrived this morning, into Suva. We're going to now get a permit to visit certain islands, and there will be some islands here in dispute that are disputed between Fiji and Tonga. Those two islands are called North Minerva Reef and South Minerva Reef. So we've learnt our lesson, and today we're going to try and get permits from the Fijians to go to these two reefs, and also get permits from the Tongans. But going back to the problem we got at the moment, inadvertently, the scientists got permission. We did everything correct as far as ship ownership and navigation wise, but we seem to have hit the headlines.
Yeah, and I mean, that's interesting that you had no idea this was going on until you actually saw it in the papers. So has anyone got in touch from Vanuatu or from New Zealand, or we've been told the UN is involved, but Prime Minister of Vanuatu has said they've been involved as well. Has any of those authorities got in touch with you?
Nobody. You're the only outside person that's spoken to me. When the ship was at one of those two islands, there was a Learjet that flew over and made contact with the boat, and that jet was from New Caledonia, just asking the skipper to please maintain contact with Noumea and let them know where he was or where the ship was every day, reporting in. So we have on the ship there's a identification system that allows anybody who wants to find out where our ship is. Our ship sends off a signal, and everybody can download that signal and say, okay, the Braveheart is there. So the Vanuatu authorities, or whoever it is in Vanuatu who tracks shipping, they would have seen when our system was turned on, they would have seen where we were. The French from Noumea could see where we were as well. And that's what obviously alerted the Vanuatu authorities, and they said, hey, there's a ship down there, and then they would have started investigating.
And is the scientific work that was conducted, is that all finished now, or is there a need to go back?
We would love to go back. We did some good work there. No, our voyage is on a pretty tight time frame. We now hope to leave Fiji. Today here is Monday. We hope to leave here very early on Wednesday morning and make our way through a group of islands called the Lau Group, then these North and South Minerva Reefs, the Kermadec Islands, and then down to Tauranga, arriving Tauranga about the 6th of September. So we don't have the opportunity to go back, but we would love to be invited back by the Vanuatu authorities at some stage.
Orcon IRL is back, live at the Golden Dawn for The Election One. Host Russell Brown and BFM's Joe Guyan-Jimena will be answering all of your most burning election queries. Featuring a stellar lineup of the political who's who, keep an eye on 95bfm.com to RSVP and for the full announcement. Orcon IRL, The Election One, live at the Golden Dawn, Sunday, August 13, 4 to 7 p.m. Streaming live on 95bfm.com and our Facebook page. Thanks to Orcon and BFM for the stream.
Glenn, what are you doing? You've been in there since 1 o'clock.
Mum, get out.
What are you... Oh my God, Glenn, you're completely soaked in gin.
Mum, it's just music.
God, you're dripping eclectic tunes and handpicked vinyl everywhere. Do you even know what genres you've been trying?
Mum, it's genre free.
Sweet Jesus, come on, into the shower. You're sweating music everywhere.
The Tuesday 1 to 4 show with Jen. 3 hours of genre-free musical exploration for your Tuesday afternoon. Right here on 95BFM. Sit back, open your ears, and let it all soak in.
To understand the distinction.
Rotorua's council has backed down on plans to use imported South Korean mud for its upcoming mud festival.
The move follows mounting public pressure over the biosecurity risks linked to outbreaks of foot-and-mouth disease in South Korea, which has spread through cloven-hooved animals. Although the Ministry for Primary Industries said that imported mud would be treated to remove any remains of the disease, this wasn't enough to satisfy farmers who would have to cull their herds if an outbreak reached New Zealand. Reporter Max Smith spoke to New Zealand Herald columnist Rachel Stewart, who broke the story and began by asking her how she was tipped off to it.
Well, I actually had a phone call from a farmer, which is quite rare for me, because farmers don't like to ring me very often because they feel that I'm sort of anti-dairy and I write a lot of stuff about dirty dairy. And the farmer said to me, look, I'm sure we don't agree on many things, but I bet you agree on this. Do you know this is happening? And I said, yeah, kind of vaguely. And we talked it through, and then I did a bit of research and thought, this is nuts. So that's how it came about, really. And I'm grateful to that farmer to tip me off.
Yeah, because, I mean, it is an odd deal that was made, obviously, going all the way to South Korea to get this mud. And, I mean, farmers were concerned with it. Well, I guess this farmer was concerned with it because once foot-and-mouth disease spreads, it gets out of control very quickly and you'd be forced to cull the farm animals. Was this kind of the main fear about this import of mud?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, foot and mouth disease is rife in South Korea. They've had many, many outbreaks and many, many animals killed. It would decimate our agricultural industry overnight. And it's always been a massive fear of farmers in New Zealand. And MPI have sort of been failing a bit lately with a number of things happening. Diseases coming in, and they're in court at the moment with, you know, over the PSA thing with the kiwi fruit growers. That started yesterday. A trial will go on for 3 months about whether they did their job there. So there's a lot of mistrust with MPI at the moment and their ability to look after New Zealand in terms of biosecurity matters. So, yeah, the fear is that would decimate the industry overnight. We would have to cull. If it was a massive outbreak in New Zealand and we couldn't contain it, and often that's the case, we would all of our animals would be gone. They would have to be culled.
Right, yeah, well, and as far as South Korea is concerned, we don't really understand what the motive was. Obviously, there was this trade deal that was going to benefit the local economy. But, I mean, the word was from MPI that this mud was going to be treated in a way that would eliminate any part of the disease. Why wasn't this, I guess, up to scratch, do you think?
Well, I think that it likely could have worked. They were thinking of they were going to irradiate it, or South Korea was, and we'd just have to trust that South Korea did it. I'm not maligning them, but unless you're there watching the process, you can't really see it happening. Irradiation also means that every single particle of that powder, because it was going to come in mud powder form, would have had to been hit and irradiated, and you can't guarantee that. It's just about impossible to make sure you've got every single granule. The irradiation process meant they were going to heat it, and that would get rid of any potential disease. But again, it just wasn't worth the risk of trusting South Korea to do it. And MPI had permitted it to happen, so they were obviously going along with it. But obviously, Todd McClay, who's the local Rotorua MP, challenged Nathan Guy and MPI on what they were doing, and it was enough for the Rotorua Lakes Council to change their mind. So I think that was a good call. Yes, it was about trade opportunities, according to Mayor Steve Chadwick in Rotorua, and I think that was a very, very misguided and short-term thinking process from her, because, yeah, it could be trade opportunities, but it could be the end of our industry. So, look, the chances are, 99-point-something chance that it wouldn't have happened, but if there's any chance whatsoever, we just shouldn't as a country be taking it.
And I guess that's what a lot of the country kind of put forward, because now with all this opposition to it, following what you came out with, the council basically have said that they're going to ask the organisers not to go through with that. I guess it remains to be seen if they'll get the $90,000 back that they paid for it. But I mean, aside from that, is this a victory, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I was really pleased to see it yesterday, and I'm really pleased that I put the column out and I brought up the issue. No, I haven't seen anyone else do it before I did. So I was kind of pleased to beat them all to the punch on it, because it was a logical, really was a logical thought process to come up with the idea that it was a risk. So yeah, I'm really pleased. I couldn't be happier. I mean, I'm a columnist. I don't usually try and break stories, but as it turns out, I did. And yeah, I'm very happy, and I've had a lot of farmers contacting me in the last 24 hours thanking me for actually bringing that subject up. So yeah, couldn't be happier about it.
That was The Wire.
That's the end of the show for another week. Thanks to all of those who spoke to us for the show today. Sue Bradford, Marama Fox, Lily Peacock, Lauren Jack, Ruby Medlicott, Nigel Jolly and Rachel Stewart. And thanks for being with us. We'll be back next week. Jin is up next with the 1 to 4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.